I want you to take a piece of paper and a pencil. Paper need be very small. And number 1 through 5 down the edge of the paper, please. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You'll need very, very little room. You'll only need to make a mark after you write the numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down the edge of the paper. Those of you who were here yesterday and are not today need not participate. The rest of us can do it from one or the other point of view. You were here and you can remember. You were not here and you can guess. I want to make 5 statements and I want you to write a T or an F for true or false after I have made the statement, and then we'll see how we come along. Number 1, the statement: a learning goal is the strongest motivation for learning. A learning goal is the strongest motivation for learning. Just put a T or an F, true or false. A learning goal is the strongest motivation for learning. Number 2, Sunday school teachers need not be concerned about the personality development of their members. Sunday school teachers need not be concerned about the personality development of their members. True or false? Don't answer too quickly. There may be some sneaky ones here. Number 3, teaching is more important than learning. Teaching is more important than learning. Number 4, real learning is different from such things as knowledge, understanding, attitudes, and values. Be careful now. Real learning is different from such things as knowledge, understanding, attitudes, and values. Number 5, the real goal of learning is progress toward maturity. The real goal of learning is progress toward maturity. All right, number 1, a learning goal is the strongest motivation for learning. How many of you agree? How many disagree? How many don't know? Who doesn't care? Who would like to argue? I made that statement yesterday. I did not have time to support it, but a character research group has spent a great deal of time in this area, and this is one of the conclusions to which they have come, that the strongest motivation for learning is for the learner to have a learning goal, which he either sets for himself or accepts from the group or even the teacher. We could enter into a great deal of interesting discussion here, but whether you accept it or not is up to you. We're just trying to recall a bit this morning. The second statement, Sunday school teachers need not be concerned about the personality development of their members. How many agree? Let's see your hands. How many of you disagree? How many of you do not know? Well, of course, this is a rather tricky question. Sunday school teachers need not be primarily concerned about personality development, but when one teaches people the Bible, personality growth, character growth, character improvement, all of these things are inevitably related. A person cannot be a growing Christian if his personality is not improving, his attitudes are not improving, and so forth. So I would have to agree with the majority of you, at least, that this is a false statement. Number 3, teaching is more important than learning. How many of you agree? Oh, a few. How many of you disagree? And how many of you still are on the fence? a few at that point even. Teaching is more important than learning. Let me ask you a question. Is it possible to learn without there being any teaching? Yes or no? Have you ever learned anything without a teacher? Are you sure? Did you ever learn anything by yourself? Yes? Well, who was teaching you then? Yourself. Do you not believe in self-teaching? Well, I'll tell you, I've learned more from myself than I have from anybody. In reality, this is a trick question. I think learning is... Sir? She cheated? Well, this is par for the course. That's my wife. She's very strong-minded, but I can change her mind by asking some questions that nobody can answer. Really, learning is the product. Teaching is the process. And the product, of course, is more important than the process. I believe this is true. But let's not undersell the value of self-teaching. Sir Walter Scott said, "The best part of any man's education is that which he gives himself." Number four, real learning. Huh? The teaching is more important than learning? It's false, I would say, though it has some aspects of truth in it. Number four, real learning is different from such things as knowledge, understanding, attitudes, and values. How many of you agree with that statement, that it is different? How many of you do not agree? Well, I guess we better go back and do the speech over again from yesterday. But I expected you, most of you, to disagree with that statement, because most of our lives we have been taught that teaching is getting knowledge, that teaching is getting understanding, or learning is, and that attitudes and values and ideas and ideals and skills and all of these things are learning. I have to disagree with that now, though I used to agree to it. Real learning to me, and if I tell you this, I'm going to ruin number five, but real learning to me is becoming, growing, developing. And these things, knowledge, attitudes, value systems, and so forth, these are the fringe benefits. You remember the term I used yesterday? These are the concomitants. These things grow out of and come along with learning, and learning is growth. You don't have to accept that, but I cannot help but accept it personally in recent years, because I feel that it is possible for a person to grow and not get any knowledge. I am reminded of a story that I'll tell you here to illustrate this point. Dr. R.G. Lee told this story some years ago. You may have heard him tell it. I only heard it one time. He said he was in the hills of Tennessee in a revival meeting. And one night after the service, a dear old country brother came to him and he said, "Dr. Lee," he said, "I ain't been a Christian too long, but I've been reading the Bible." And he said, "I found something in it I need some help with." He says, "What does it mean when the Bible says something about tithy?" And Dr. Lee says, "I would rather he would call it tithy and tithe than to call it tithe and not tithy." Here is the point of the whole thing. It's better to be a tither than to be able to explain what tithing means. This is growth. So I have to accept, and I could go on and on in that, but I have to accept the fact that growth is learning, and that in the process of growing, we gain some information. We gain some attitudes that are valuable. We gain some skills. We gain some value systems, or a value system that is Christian. All of these things are wonderful, but they are not really learning. They are only evidence of learning. They are only the concomitants of learning. They are only the fringe benefits from learning. Learning is even more valuable than these things. So number five, as I said, I ruined it, but I felt it was necessary. The real goal of learning is progress toward maturity. You agree? You disagree? All right. Maybe we passed the course yesterday. I'm not sure, but we got agreement anyway. Why did I ask you to do these things? There is a reason. Even though I have said that growth is learning and that growth is more important than knowledge, there is a great deal of value in knowledge. One of the most difficult things in learning knowledge, acquiring knowledge, is to retain it. It is easy to forget data. There is a scientific formula for remembering things you want to remember. I do not have time to explain it. I'll only give it to you. The second day after you learn a thing, if you will review it, it will stay with you better. The fifth day after you have learned something, if you will review it, it will become rather strong. On the tenth day, if you will review it, you are likely to remember it as long as you need it. On the 20th day, if you will review it, you probably will remember it for life. This is a scientific formula that has been tested and proven. Now, that is only in the area of memory. Concepts may be learned in a flash of a moment and remembered as long as we live. Now, if in school, if any of you are teachers, I guess you're not, you wouldn't be here if you were, but if in school they would review on the second day, the fifth day, the tenth day, and the 20th day, they could forget the examinations. I wish my teachers had known that. I'd have been a lot happier. This morning, we want to discuss the subject to the question, how does learning occur? There are many, many ways we could approach this subject because it is a very broad one. And as on yesterday morning, about all I can do will be to try to confuse you. But if you can't teach anybody anything, confuse them. This is the next best step. I'm going to start from the physiological side of learning. I don't believe I've ever heard anyone else ever approach learning from the physiological aspect. It may not be worth anything, but it is most interesting. I want to say first that the learners do not learn simply because they are expected to learn. Now, that's a very trite statement, but there's a lot in it. Learners do not learn simply because they are expected to. If this were the case, everybody in the country would be well educated. And everyone who attended our Sunday school would know all there is to know about the Bible and the Christian way of life. But attendance and on a learning project does not necessarily mean that we learn. Your attendance here this morning and this week does not guarantee that you will learn anything or that you will grow at all as a teacher or Sunday school officer. And I hate to tell you this, but simply because members attend your classes does not necessarily mean that they learn. And I'm afraid that in the majority of our classes, people do not really learn because our teachers do not know what is necessary in learning. Most of us seem to think that teaching is spraying the pupils with the truth and that learning is absorbing the spray. This is rather ridiculous, but this is the way most of us operate. Let me say it again, that we do not learn simply because we attend a learning situation. Now, for a number of years, educators have been greatly concerned about teaching improvement. But I have in recent years come to conclude that that's the wrong concern. What we need to be concerned about is learning improvement. We've been working with the process instead of the product. If a factory was more concerned about keeping the machinery in good operating condition than it was about the product the machine was taking out, putting out, that company would be out of business in a short time. And we have been so concerned with the process of teaching that we have overlooked the outcome, the product, which is learning. We have felt that if we had the right process or a good process, that we would have the right product, the right outcome. And this is not the case either. However, I do want to hasten to add that we must be concerned both with teaching and with learning because they are two sides of the same coin. Now, why do we have to learn? Isn't that an elementary question? Well, let me tell you why. Human being is born completely helpless and dependent upon other persons until he learns. Completely helpless. The animal kingdom is not like this, but the human is. Human being is born with a great capacity for learning, but he knows absolutely nothing. Now, at least at this point, we're all equal. We got started off on the same foot. The human being must become a responsible person, but he enters the world completely irresponsible. Got quite a goal ahead of him, hasn't he? The human being must be able to express himself and communicate with others, but he is born completely inarticulate. The human being must be able to discipline and control himself, but he arrives on the scene completely helpless and without any form of control or discipline. The human being must be able to think, select, choose, and discriminate between values, but he comes into a world that is full of untruth, misconceptions, prejudice, and false values. And not only must he learn for himself, but he must learn how to live in such a wretched environment. Why is it necessary to learn? Because it's the only way we can hope to get out of the mess we arrive here in. Now, to understand the learning process, I would like to raise three questions and hope to answer them. One, what takes place when learning occurs? This will be the physiological aspect. How do persons actually learn? And what is the evidence of learning? Now, there's a very complicated and a very interesting physical basis for learning. All of us are aware of the fact that there are five entrances into the consciousness of personality. We call them the five senses. An individual is totally unable to communicate if he does not have any of the five senses. His communication is handicapped to the point he has either a poor quality of communication in any one of these or none at all. For instance, if a person does not see, he is handicapped in communicating. If he does not hear, he is handicapped in communicating, and so forth. So all kinds of learning, every aspect of learning, is dependent upon these five avenues of communication. Now, in the sense organs, the hearing organs, and so forth, there are small end organs, nerves, which are called receptors. These receptors are in constant contact with the world around us. Let's assume that some stimulus contacts one of these end organs or receptors. Immediately, when this contact occurs, a sound in your ear, for example, an impulse, which is electrical, really, is relayed to a neuron in the arm, or in this case, the ear, since we're using the ear as an illustration, and that impulse is carried to the proper place, and the proper place is where it's wired up to go, in the brain, of course. Now, these neurons, these places where we are touched by a stimulus, are called conductors. So we have, on the one hand, a receptor and a conductor. The receptor, in this case, is the ear, and the conductor is the nerve running from the ear to the brain. Now, when the stimulus is received, a signal is sent by the conductor to the effectors. In most cases, these are muscles. And these effectors receive and use the signal which has been sent in. The nervous system then acts as a switchboard and a trunk line to relay the message to the proper place. All this has happened long before I tell you all about it, but this is the way it happens. Now, to complicate this matter, that is the understanding of it at least, there are several levels of response to any message which is given. And it's more than the physical. A loud noise, for instance, gets a whole lot more response than a soft noise. This is just an extreme illustration. But this is not the interesting thing about it at all. when a response comes in, when the stimulus is picked up, when it's received, when it's conducted, when it is switched to the right place in the brain, something happens. Up to this point, there has been an electrical impulse. But through a process which no one can understand or explain, this impulse is changed to a chemical process. And the response then enters into the consciousness of the individual. Up to the time the stimulus and has been coming all the way to the body and the chemical process takes place, this has been material. It has been electrical. It can even be measured on electrical instruments. But once the chemical change has been made, and once the message is inside the brain, the material or the physical is miraculously transformed into something completely new, and it becomes mental rather than physical. Now, no one knows how this transformation takes place. Nobody knows when it takes place exactly. We only know that at one moment, here is a physical impulse, and then at another moment, there is a mental process. And at that time, a stimulus from outside turns into a piece of information, or a feeling, an emotion, or to a decision, a volitional decision, so forth. Now, this is all quite interesting, and I've described it only very, very briefly. It's very, very fascinating to study, but this is beyond, really, our realm of comprehension because the scientists do not actually understand it. And even if we did understand it, it isn't worth a great deal. I only point it out to you to say that this process, which is physical to mental, is so extremely complicated that no one understands it. But the learning situation, the learning process itself, is even more complicated than that. So if you have difficulty understanding what you hear, if you have difficulty understanding what learning is, if you have difficulty in learning itself, then you're normal. Don't worry about it. Just try to do something about it. Now another question I would like to ask is, how do persons learn? There are many ways to approach this question. But we say generally that experience is a dear teacher, and we also sometimes add, and fools can learn no other way. Now, that always bothered me until I found out that no one else can either. Experience is a dear teacher, and fools and anybody else can learn only through experience. Every learning is an experience. So if I may take the experience approach, and there are many other approaches we could take, but this one seems to be a little the easiest to understand, I would like to point out that there are probably at least 8 types of experience which we may have through which we may learn. Let's start with one of the easiest ones. Learning takes place sometimes through imitation. Imitation. Learning through imitation is more prominent during babyhood and childhood than at any other time of life, but it operates at all ages. It even operates on a highly sophisticated adult level. I started to give an illustration, but I'm too far from that illustration to make it probably worthwhile here. Some of you who have lived in other parts of the nation, Texas specifically, may recall that 15 to 25 years ago, there was a great preacher in Dallas, Texas, by the name of George W. Truett. Some of you may have at least heard the name. He was the outstanding preacher of the Southwest for many years, a tremendous preacher. And for a generation, almost every young preacher in the seminary and shortly after the seminary imitated Dr. Truett, both in his voice tones and in his mannerisms, because they had learned something, at least, through imitation. Now, without any reference to the illustration I've just given, because I do not want to seem critical, let me say that imitation on the adult level is a very poor way to learn, because we normally pick up the idiosyncrasies of an individual rather than the values. There was a time in my young adult life when I felt that I simply must do something about my personality. As some of my colleagues are here, no, I never did make any success with it. But I tried, and I decided that the best thing I could do would be to pick out all of the things that I saw in interesting persons and try to imitate those things. So I gave it a real heave-ho college try. And I wound up realizing that all I had done was to accumulate and imitate all of the odd characteristics of a whole lot of people. And instead of being a screwball, I had become an oddball. So I had finally decided the best thing to do was just to try to be what I was and to try to improve it and knock off a few of the rough edges. It was certainly a great relief to me to come to conclude that I did not have to imitate other people to be and to learn what God would want me to be and what He would want me to learn. But we learn a great deal through imitation. The habits of life, which we have, mostly were learned through imitation. Our customary way of thinking mostly was learned through imitation. The attitudes which we have generally came from imitation, generally from our family. Many of our responses are molded and shaped through the imitation of other persons, particularly those who have a prestige value for the learner. This is why I said about the preachers imitating Scarborough. That's an interesting thing. I don't think I ever remember seeing or hearing a Sunday school worker trying to imitate Dr. J.N. Barnett, and to me he was the greatest we've ever had. I don't know why this is the case. I guess we just all stood in awe and realized it couldn't be done anyway. Now, the imitative aspect of learning largely accounts for the traditions and the mores and the cultural differences in homes and schools and universities, social groups, regions, nations. In a convention, Southern Baptists are different from any other group. This may be good or bad, but we're different anyway. And the imitation of leaders along through has helped do this. Now, teachers eventually find the members of their group imitating their own habit patterns, thought patterns, conduct patterns, attitudes, and responses. And it is definitely true that a class eventually becomes a carbon copy of the teacher. This is why it is so utterly important that we have the right people teaching in the areas where significant leadership must be exerted. Paul recognized this, and he put himself on the line when he said, "Be ye followers or imitators of me." Learning also takes place not only through imitation, but through investigation. The inquisitive mind causes a small child to handle everything in his reach. It causes the youth to raise questions and doubt authority. May, in these days, even go beyond that. It sends the scientist in search of unknown laws of God's creation. It sends a soldier of fortune to unexplored regions. And it sends a hungry mind to a library. Investigation. Teachers can use this normal inquisitiveness of a learner and direct them to the Word of Life for answers. So many times we tell people something when we ought to be leading them to discover it for themselves. Anytime a pupil asks a question, it ought to be answered with a directive back to the source, the authority for this. And this is, of course, the Word of God. Jesus himself, who was the greatest teacher, admonished his followers to search the Scriptures. Now, learning takes place through participation. This is very obvious to most all of us. Learners have to be actively involved in meaningful activities. Activity alone is of little value. It has to be a meaningful participation. It must be purposeful. It must be planned. It needs to be supervised. Busy work is out of place in the Sunday school. We need supervised activity and participation. In Mark 14, Jesus taught the disciples the meaning of the Lord's Prayer by leading them to participate in it. And at this place, he furnished a wonderful example for all teachers, so that they could plan experiences for the learners to participate in and to be involved in as they learn, because learning takes place beautifully through participation. Learning takes place through observation as well. The psalmist said, "Open mine eyes that I might see." This ought to be the prayer of every teacher, I think, because it calls for an awareness, for perception, for the ability to see beyond the perfectly obvious. Now, observation is one of God's gateways to learning. They tell us that 24% of what we hear is retained, and about 46% of what we see is retained. And what we see and hear at the same time, that is hearing backed up with sight, a visual of some type, that 86% of it is retained. So it says to us that good learning and good teaching requires a well-planned use of visual materials, tools, talk chalkboards, maps, flip charts, books, pictures, whatever is essential to the material to be learned, because learning takes place through observation. The children's workers use this a great deal, particularly at Glorietta and Ridgecrest. Since I am not an expert in that area, I won't offer any opinion, but on the adult level, this sort of learning is rather valueless unless there is very careful evaluation of what has been observed. Not a technique, but of the participation, the involvement, and the activities of the learners.